Today on Against the Grain. In 2017, the so-called drug war in Mexico had its bloodiest year yet, and it shows no sign of abating. Lost in the gruesome headlines is any sense of what's driving the violence and the role that the Mexican state plays in it. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll be joined by Mexico-based journalist John Gibler to talk about the forces underlying the slaughter there, including the political attack upon and disappearance of left-wing student teachers in the state of Guerrero. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. On the night of September 26, 2014, police killed six, wounded more than 40, and disappeared 43 people in the city of Iguala, Mexico, in a political crime that rocked the country. The 43 students from the Teachers College in Ayotzinapa have still not been found, but the political cover-up appears to extend all the way to the top of the Mexican state. Journalist John Gibler interviewed the survivors, witnesses, and families of the students and wove together a story of the attack. First published in Spanish, the book is now available in English from City Lights Books, and it's called I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students of Ayotzinapa. Gibler has written extensively about political violence and the so-called drug war in Mexico and joins me today on the phone from there. John, what do we know about what took place on that night in September in Iguala?
Now, 40 months after those attacks, we know that more than 150 plus local, municipal, state and federal police, all uniformed, collaborated also with ununiformed armed men to attack five buses of college students from the Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College in Ayotzinapa, Guerrero. They also attacked a sixth bus with a youth semi-professional soccer team from Chilpancingo called Los Avispones. The attacks took place over more than 9 hours, over a very wide geographical area, both inside the city of Iguala and way beyond the city of Iguala out on the highways. And over the course of the attacks, the police and ununiformed armed men killed six people, wounded more than 40, one of whom is still in a coma 40 months later with a bullet wound to the head, and forcibly disappeared 43 Ayotzinapa students.
What was the official story at first about what took place?
The official stories initially were multiple and confused and often contradictory. They initially said that the students hadn't been disappeared, but they were just scared and hiding in the mountainsides and would soon be coming home. They said that drug gangs confused the students for a rival drug gang, and thus that's why they attacked them. They said that the students had gone to protest the Iguala mayor's wife's political event in the center of Iguala City that night, and the mayor and his wife had connections to organized crime and thus ordered the police to attack the students for that reason. All of these things, which were the initial descriptions of the events, turned out to be false. Of course, the students never even knew about the political event that took place that night in Iguala and concluded without any disturbances. There was absolutely no confusion of the students for a rival drug gang. That's not only patently absurd, but throughout the attacks, the police yelled at them and constantly identified them as being students of Ayotzinapa using a negative term for Ayotzinapa students. They call them Ayotzinapos, which is like the negative derogatory term. And of course, the students themselves were, the 43 were disappeared, in fact. They were not hiding in the hills. So that was the initial government response, both local and state. The federal government initially said it was a state issue and wasn't their business, so they didn't think it was very important and working to get involved. Of course, as the aftermath and the events unfolded, the government lies became clear. The parents and the colleagues of the students increasingly desperate to find their children and their colleagues, and mobilizing across the state, then the federal government jumped into action, took over the case, and within a month or so put forth a description of the events that combined a number of the initial official versions, again, kind of contradictory, saying that the students had gone to attack, protest this political event, which was, you know, just never happened, a bald-faced lie, and then also saying that the police had confused the students for being a rival drug trafficking organization, and that they had taken the 43 disappeared students to a trash dump, an open-air trash dump in a nearby town called Kokula, and during the pre-dawn hours then of September 27th, 2014, proceeded to incinerate the 43 students, murder, pile their bodies on top of old tires and wood, and feed the flames with gasoline and incinerate them throughout the pre-dawn hours all the way into the late afternoon of the 27th of September, between 3 and 5 p.m. This has now been conclusively disproven. There was no fire whatsoever at the Kokula trash dump on the night and then day of September 27th. And yet the Mexican federal government, 40 months later, continues to just simply repeat its lies and pursue no other lines of investigation.
So what do we know? There have been international investigations. There's been the tireless work of journalists like you. What do we now know actually took place, to the degree that we do know what took place that night?
Well, I think the really horrifying, sad reality is that there's still so much we don't know, because, again, the particular terror of forced disappearance is condemning people, especially, of course, the families, the loved ones of the disappeared, to an anguished state of not knowing. But there is a lot that we do know that I think is very important and can be very helpful for trying to find the 43 students. And this is mainly from the exhaustive documentation we now have of the events that night in the streets in Iguala and outside of Iguala. We know that this was a major operation, right? It wasn't an accident or a confusion. The level of coordination between the various different police forces shows that they are in constant electronic communication, right, using either cell phones and or radios, because they're coordinating over vast geographical distances to attack these busloads of students in the one bus of the soccer team. We know thus that there was a chain of command also because of the various levels, different security forces, the police forces involved. You have three different municipal police forces, Iguala, Kokula, and Huitzuco, state police forces from the state of Guerrero, as well as federal police forces. Also, we now know that the Mexican federal armed forces had civilian-dressed military intelligence agents physically present at least one of the major scenes of attack and mass force disappearance, documenting the scene, taking photographs, and reporting in real time to their superiors. So the presence is also, of course, there's a major military base in Iguala, an army base located 1.6 kilometers, that's just about a mile away from one of the major scenes of attack and forced disappearance. So the presence and the role of the armed forces is also undeniable, although we still haven't been able to exhaustively document that role, principally because the Mexican federal government, the armed forces, have denied all requests for any interviews whatsoever with the soldiers stationed in Iguala on that night. But we also know, and I think this is incredibly important, that as soon as the physical attacks conclude, all, in a coordinated fashion, all layers of government, municipal, state, and federal, coordinate to lie, to destroy physical evidence, to make it impossible to document what happened and make it impossible to find the students. And for me, that isn't just, it's definitely not incompetence, it's too coordinated and too maintained over time. And it's not just a cover-up. I think it's the administrative and legal continuation of the attack itself, the atrocity itself, the forced disappearance. And so we are able to document all the ways in which initially the mayor of Iguala, then later the Guerrero state government, and then later the Mexican federal government, including the president's office, the armed forces, and the attorney general's office, all collaborate to lie, to destroy physical evidence, to torture people, to produce false confessions, to produce a lie, a false narrative about the events. And that leads us just to a question, like, what is so devastating, what is so horrible that it would lead the entire structure of the state to so absurdly lie, to exhaust itself in such evident and transparent lies to try and keep concealed? What are they hiding?
Tell us who the victims were and why you think they were attacked.
Well, the main targets of attack that night were students of the Ayotzinapa Rural Teacher School, which is, I'll try to say this as briefly as possible, one of the kind of holdout organizations of radical socialist rural organizing in Mexico. The students at Ayotzinapa are a member of a nationwide rural Teachers College Student Socialist Federation, and they are intensely politicized and intensely active, mainly about protecting the existence itself of these rural teachers' colleges, which, you know, come from a time in Mexican history after the Mexican Revolution of social effervescence and crafting education curricula for rural peoples, for indigenous and campesino peoples across Mexico. And these are schools that the Mexican regime has been trying to eliminate for decades. And the ones that do survive only survive because of the incredible student activism. So this is, you know, it's been a sore spot in the for the Mexican state for many decades. You know, very famously, two of the most active guerrilla leaders of the late 1960s and early 1970s in Mexico, Genaro Vázquez and Lucio Colañas, were both graduates of the Ayotzinapa Rural Teachers College. And so there is a long history of intense student organizing on the one hand and state repression against the school on the other hand. This isn't the first time Ayotzinapa has been a target. And so I definitely think the nature of the school, the nature of the student organizing, who these students are is profoundly, of course, relevant to why they were attacked. I don't think, and I don't buy for a second the speculations that the students were confused for a rival drug gang, nor that they simply didn't understand the nature of the relationship between drug trafficking in the state and that region, and kind of, you know, stumbled into an area that they didn't understand. I think they were explicitly targeted for who they are. And again, I think that because of, through my interviews with survivors that night and their testimonies, the ways in which the police constantly identified them, insulted them, you know, called them, you know, Ayotzinapos with all sorts of swear words, and threatened them as they were attacking and then later disappearing, the 43. And it also, that attack comes in a context of consistent state repression and mobilization against other rural and indigenous movements, the Zapatista movement in Chiapas, the dissident teachers union in Oaxaca, dissident teachers in Michoacan, and as well the, you know, longstanding indigenous community police forces, which is a whole other long story in itself, but that were also, you know, explicitly targeted by state operations in the years and months leading up to September 26th to 27th, 2014.
Independent journalist John Gibler is my guest. He's based in Mexico. We're talking about his book, I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students of Ayotzinapa. That's published by City Lights. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you were making the argument that this attack, which really rocked Mexico, was an act of political violence. We will talk more in the hour about the larger violence and terror that characterizes much of life in Mexico now. Political violence, in a sense, gets lost in the scope of so much violence that is termed the drug war. Would you say that that is part of the story?
I absolutely think so. I think it's a very complex and hard to understand, hard to disentangle history of the past 12 or so years. But I think there has, without a doubt, been a kind of merger between so-called organized crime and so-called security forces, the state and narcos, and then, to use that language, and the forms of violence that they use. I think that there, that as the mercantile organized crime organizations, which always include members of the state, started to take on, to incorporate state practices of state terror. Similarly, the state institutions, which always include elements of organized crime, started to incorporate a lot of the forms of violence most typically associated with so-called gangland or mafia or narco violence, and that there's been a confusion and a merger both of the institutions, the actors, and the practices of violence in a way that's made it incredibly difficult to read and to understand what's happening on the one hand, but also very, I think, beneficial for state practitioners of violence, because so much political violence gets disregarded as just being, oh, that's, you know, more, you know, narco people killing each other. And that itself as itself incorporated into state discourse. And there's a famous case about 10 or so years ago of an army general who came to take over policing in the state of Chihuahua and told reporters, very annoyed at them and their, you know, the reporters being upset about all the violence, that don't think about one more dead body, think about one less criminal, right? So here's the direct production of state discourse, accusing anyone who turns up murdered is basically guilty of their own murder. And that has been repeated endlessly, even very recently in the state of Veracruz, where the horrific, horrific act of finding bodies dismembered in a vehicle. And the state governor said, oh, but those aren't bodies, those aren't people, those are criminals, right?
And that echoes out in terms of how the violence in Mexico seems to be seen from the outside, because there is such widespread levels of violence that's ostensibly connected to the drug war, that if there is violence that's directed against activists or people who are engaged in political protest, it sort of disappears in the way that violence against political protesters or political activists before the relaunch of the drug war in 2006, there was more attention on the outside to acts against political activists.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at just things that come quickly to mind, in the late 1990s, the massacres of indigenous activists in Ocotlán, Chiapas in 1997, or in Guerrero in Aguas Blancas in 1995, were major international scandals. And there was, initial state attempts always to depoliticize and say, oh, well, the Aguas Blancas campesinos were actually armed and shot at the police first, which turned out to be, of course, a lie. Or in Chiapas to say that this was inter-community land disputes, right, that led to the massacre, which again turned out to be a lie. They were military-trained paramilitaries who attacked the community. And then with the attacks against the students in Ayotzinapa, the immediate discourse of the state is to dissolve any political mention of the violence with the use of the so-called narco category, right? Oh, by both trying to implicate the students somehow, because there are also, I forgot to mention this earlier, but there are also leaked versions to the press. The government didn't say this explicitly, but they would leak this to different, to put it kindly, sympathetic media outlets who would then publish, oh, well, we have information from, anonymous sources in the government that not all of them, but a handful of the students were actually involved in drug trafficking. So try to blame them, right, by saying that they were really gangsters. And then when that fails, when it's just completely untenable and impossible and disproven, then, oh, well, they were confused, right? I think you're exactly right that has become fully incorporated into the state's response and discourse around political violence, trying to dissolve it into drug violence.
Why did you decide to write an oral history of the attacks, presenting the perspectives of witnesses, survivors, and the families of the disappeared?
I went to Ayotzinapa about a week after the attacks, and initially I was just trying to find out, okay, what happened, right? There was so much confusion and misinformation and rumors and lies being spread directly by the government and in the media, that initially, thinking as a reporter and a movement reporter, I was like, okay, wait, let's just go talk to the people who know, the people who were there, the survivors, and try to figure out what happened, right? And that was my initial impetus. And then as I gathered that information, did a couple of early pieces written and radio, including with you, then I felt like there was so much more that needed to be documented. Of course, we were still looking for the 43 students, as we're still looking now, and I continued going to the school for months and months, and over time as well, a number of the survivors who had initially gone to the school but then gone back to their homes and spent a couple of months with their families slowly started going back to the school to reincorporate themselves into the movement and the struggle to find their colleagues, their compañeros. And so over the course of many months, I was able to interview more and more survivors as they came back to the school. And after about 9 or so months, as the first anniversary of the attacks approached, I wanted to find some way to share the material and the information and the knowledge that I'd been able to gather with everyone, with the movement here in Mexico, initially in Spanish. And then it just kind of appeared to me in a flash of sorts that I wouldn't write, that it wasn't the moment for me, or there was no need for me to try and compose a narrative, right, to tell the story, that I'd listen to the people who could really tell the story, and that I would be able to compose a unified narrative with all of their different stories and testimonies. So I sat down trying to see, first off, if it would work narratively. And as I reread all the transcripts that I'd done and started trying to put them together, and then I decided that I thought that would be the most kind of honest and effective way to share what I'd be able to learn and gather.
You spoke earlier about the extent of what you said is more than a cover-up on sort of every layer, every level of political life in Mexico around this, up to the president, and mentioned the disappearance of the bodies of the students. And we're talking about the attack that took place on September 26, 2014, in the state of Guerrero in Iguala, the town of Iguala, Mexico, where 6 people were killed and 43 people disappeared and still disappeared to this day from teachers' college. Why do you think the state would be invested in the bodies not being discovered?
First off, I think it's super important to emphasize that we can't assume that we're even talking about bodies yet, right? And not people, living people. That's the particular terror of forced disappearances that you're condemned not to know. And the families can't, or many families can't, just assume. And so that question, in a sense, is unanswerable because I can't conceive of 43 bodies yet. I'm still thinking about 43 compas, right, 43 students. And just as the parents continue to demand that they be presented, found, returned alive, I think that's the demand that we have to continue with. So in terms of trying to answer the question of why the state would have done anything like this, I mean, some people like us, I think, we're condemned only to wild speculation, right, when you're trying to think about motivations to do something horrendous of this nature, inconceivable. And so I can't formulate a speculation as to why they would do it, but I think we can ask ourselves what has been produced, right? What did the events do, or what are they continuing to do? And that is a very clear answer, that it produced widespread terror, social terror, pain, trauma. Of course, immediately, and the students attacked in their families, in the entire student body of the school, more broadly in the social movements in the state, and then, of course, just across the country, students, activists, people involved in social movements, a very devastating and widespread reality of state terror. That leads me to think, okay, these people organized this extremely complex operation, which involved all of these different layers of different police forces initially, and then later all of these different layers of administrative institutions of the state, with the full weight, from the literally the president to the secretary of defense to the federal attorney general, full weight of the state supporting the administrative continuation of the attacks, continuation of the atrocities. It seems like, okay, they're doing this on purpose, which leads me to a kind of attempt at that's what they wanted to do. Or add an answer, right? It's some kind of answer that isn't entirely only speculative. Are they doing what they want to do? In which case, what they want to do appears to be, instill terror and horror.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today, I'm joined by John Gibler, who writes extensively about political violence and the so-called drug war in Mexico. His latest book is I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students of Ayotzinapa. That's published by City Lights Books, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. His other books include Mexico Unconquered and To Die in Mexico. And today we're talking about the attacks that took place on September 26th in 2014 and the wider politics and economics of terror in Mexico. And to broaden our discussion, John, we've been talking about a particular act or series of acts that took place in one place. But as you say, although it shook Mexico, it's not at all an isolated incident. And I wonder if you could just give us a sense for a moment of the extent of state and extra-state violence in Mexico today, just the scope of it as it takes place now.
It's devastating. I mean, the news headlines right now, for example, are, 2017, the most violent year on record in Mexico, with more than 27,000 people murdered in one year. Headlines of just the last couple of days are kind of soul-crushing, and there's a confluence of just, murder, like just the other day in Reynosa, there are, shootouts going on throughout the night in the early morning hours, blockades in the street, cars being torched. In one 24-hour period, I think at least nine people were killed. So, street battles. In Chihuahua State, I'm in Chihuahua at the moment. When I arrived, over a course of one weekend between two cities, Ciudad Juarez and City of Chihuahua, 24 people were executed on the street, murdered on the street. A news headline from the other day, a woman was murdered by her ex-husband and mutilated in a horrifying fashion. There's Central American migrant routes through Mexico on the way to the United States are still basically this kind of semi-industrialized death market being preyed upon by all sorts of armed actors, disappeared, robbed, beaten, enslaved. More journalists have been murdered in Mexico in the last 10 years than any point in the country's history, one of the most perilous countries in the world for journalists, and an overarching context of pretty remarkable impunity, right? Impunity itself still almost kind of unwieldy concept, since it seems to hint that somewhere there's a legal structure that, quote, works, unquote, and rather the impunity itself is a part of the machinery of the killing, or right, the incentive impunity, following the lead of something I heard writer Francisco Goldman say one time that impacted me. He said impunity is just the freedom of expression of the killers.
Looking at what's called the drug war, and you argue it's much more complicated than that, over the last decade plus, since 2006, what can we say about the trajectory of the players from a, let's say, an economic standpoint? Who are they? Have they changed? Have they grown? Has their form changed? What are we talking about? What entities are the players in this?
Well, I think over the last 10 plus years, as the so-called war has increased, the market has boomed. The war has been excellent business. All forms of kind of drug markets have expanded, with an interesting exception, that being marijuana, as the United States has been, you know, slowly, selectively legalizing marijuana in different contexts and different forms. It's made it extremely difficult for Mexican marijuana businesses to compete, and so they've, in many cases, shifted for export production to poppies, right? To heroin production, which is something the U.S. can't compete with. And you see, of course, in the context of the U.S., the increase in availability and consumption of heroin. But in everywhere, both in the United States and in Mexico, the drug war is constantly, I mean, and not just the last 10 years, but starting in the U.S. over 40 years ago, it's just good business. It's excellent business. That's why, that's one of the reasons I think it's still being pursued, where in any even half purportedly serious or sober, no pun intended, analysis, you would see the drug war as a colossal failure to in any way address actual public health issues associated with substance abuse. I mean, the policies, I think, have been so vigorously pursued in the United States, from the United States, and then imposed all across Latin America, countries as well, because it's just really excellent business. And it also
can you explain that? You're arguing that it's the drug war is really not about public health. So how is it such good business?
A couple of things. One, when you make the products illegal, then it creates structures the whole market. It creates the price markup from, you know, a leaf that, you know, is pennies to the pound in Colombia to being, you know, a powder that's tens of thousands of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars to the pound once you get it across a couple of borders. So the illegality creates the possibility of an incredibly lucrative market, and also a market that that provides, you know, massive amounts of cash, which is useful for people for doing all sorts of other things. And it's proved itself to be extremely useful for disguising all kinds of state repression and state violence. Of course, in the United States, the drug war has been, for more than 40 years, a kind of insidious technology to try and disguise racist oppression or all sorts of forms of racialized violence. In Mexico, it's also been applied with race, class, intent, but in a very different way, because race politics in Mexico are quite different than the United States. But still, it's doubly an excellent business model and an excellent political model for violence, for creating, or for controlling and repressing.
You write of terror in Mexico, that there is, and now this is keeping with what we're discussing right now, the sort of economics of the drug war, that one component of it is an extractive industry of death. What do you mean by that?
That's really looking at the Mexican experience over the last 10 years as the Calderon administration, you know, embraced this U.S. designed and initially imposed logic of a war on drugs and a war on drug traffickers. They, you know, infused their military and their police with all kinds of funds coming directly from the United States through the Merida Initiative, also, you know, Mexican appropriated funds. And of course, if you've got all this money flowing into your armies and police, you've got to do something with it. You've got to produce something for the television cameras and the newspapers. And so they decided to go and try to eliminate a couple of small drug trafficking organizations so that they could say, hey, basically do propaganda, right, for the war. And they ended up setting off a series of very real battles that I don't think they understood. But they couldn't admit the mistake that they'd actually made. So actually, we never, of course, wanted to combat. We just thought we'd pick up this one little organization to do some good public relations work, and it failed. And so they constantly refueled the strategy of using the Strait just to try to eliminate a handful of organizations, not understanding, of course, that those organizations all have deep structural relationships with the state itself. They're constantly subverting the attempts to eliminate them because they have good information, they ambush the police, etc. And at the same time, because the whole thing is a farce, no one's ever investigating, no state authorities are investigating any of these murders, any of them. And so this broad context of impunity or freedom of expression, freedom of movement for the killers, which creates the possibility of semi-industrializing various forms of violent crime. So kidnapping has always existed, extortion has always existed, human trafficking and human smuggling both always existed. In this new context of a bogus, relatively bogus and very real war, real in a different way than the way it presents itself, of course, then these organizations have to, it expands their market potential, it expands their fields for movement, and they turn everything that existed on maybe a mom-and-pop small scale before into these grand scale. So, you know, now you have not just kidnapping someone every couple of months and trying to get a ransom, but, for example, take just one concrete and very relevant example, the municipal police of the city of Iguala themselves setting up roadblocks on all of the highways that go in and out of the city, and through those roadblocks or checkpoints, carrying out mass kidnappings. And because it's the state that's kidnapping, it's the police that's kidnapping, when they don't get the money, or maybe when they don't get enough, or maybe just because it's easier to kill and murder the person and put their body half-burned in a hole in the ground in the outskirts of town, because, of course, the police, the law, who's going to investigate, then you see this merger, right, and this embracing of state practices of terror now as parts of death economies. A lot of this comes from, some of this thinking comes from testimonies of family members, people who had been disappeared in Iguala before the students were attacked on September 26th and 27th of 2014. They ended up organizing, creating an organization called The Other Disappeared, or Nosotros Desaparecidos, that started looking for their family members in shallow graves in the outskirts of town. Once they saw that after the students had been attacked and disappeared, and the government initially very quickly found and extracted 28 human remains, 28 bodies from a mass shallow grave that turned out not to be the students, that led these families to say, oh, well, maybe there are more bodies, and maybe we can find, that's where we'll find our loved ones who have been disappeared, have been missing. And so from gathering those testimonies, we were able to get a picture of a pre-existing state terror operation, you know, before the attacks against the students, that was, of course, intimately, infinitely political, but also mercantile. These were the local police who, because Iguala is a major transit point in the transnational heroin shipment routes from Guerrero to the United States. And in the context of this so-called war where nobody's actually trying to not only destroy but even minimally interrupt the production of the commodities, the production of heroin, these major players are given their freedom of movement in the city and turn it into this death market.
John Gibler, how can we understand the kind of terror that you're describing, which the state plays a role in actively, and which death has its own economic logic? How is that connected to the larger economic system of neoliberal capitalism in Mexico? This is a country that has experienced mass privatization of what used to be a very large state sector. There have been enormous economic changes that have taken place in Mexico, at least since the early 90s.
I think the drug economies, the illegal drug economies, fit entirely into the NAFTA, you know, hyper-capitalist economic restructuring of Mexico from the early 90s on. And they're intimately linked with other extractive industries like mining, natural gas, oil, a lot of industrial agriculture. So in the same years that we've seen this, you know, mass funding and fueling of the war, which has created these hideous death markets, so to speak, of, you know, kidnapping and disappearing and extortion, Central American migrants, people all across Mexico, that period coincides with all of these, you know, liberalization reforms of the energy sector, of oil and gas, of education, the continuing breakdown of any kind of public services, and the hyper-fueling of various extractive industries. Mining explodes in Mexico over the past 10-plus years, coinciding with all of this state terror. There's, you know, been intimate links between, for example, methamphetamine labs and lime and avocado production in Michoacán for export to the United States. So I very much see the drug commodities themselves, as well as the commodification of suffering and death linked to them in the context of the so-called war, as well as the political uses of the war, all intimately woven into the fabric of capitalism as it shifts and contorts to survive.
We're almost out of time, so I want to squeeze a question that deserves much more than a short answer, which is, you've written that the drug war is the creation and project of the United States, although it's been embraced and innovated by the governments of Colombia, Mexico, and elsewhere. Explain what you mean by that, and what people in the U.S. who may be horrified about what's going on in Mexico should be doing, if they can be doing anything.
The drug war was very much designed and elaborated and put into practice initially in the United States. And from the very, very beginning, it was, you know, a racist war, largely against the black population in the United States, but also from its very inception linked to violence and oppression against Mexico. The first, one of the first major actions in Nixon's so-called drug war was to close the border with Mexico and force Mexico to step into the Nixon approach, right? And, you know, several things there. But over the decades of elaboration, the drug war has been unleashed across the United States as a racist tool of oppression with, again, just like in Mexico, incalculable human suffering and pain. And in terms of what people can do, I mean, I'm not anybody to tell anybody else what to do. I think the extent to which we constantly call into question the logics of the state, the logics of the officials, the self-descriptions they use to try and justify really horrendous forms of violence. And the more as well, and personally, that we don't look to that same state for redress, we don't constantly orient our analysis and thinking and speech to the state that, you know, the extent to which we discuss amongst ourselves, organize amongst ourselves, take care of each other amongst ourselves. Always, of course, there'll be an antagonistic relationship by necessity with the state, but the extent to which we move away from state-centered solutions, or at least expand the horizons of solutions to consider moments and options and actions that don't involve asking permission or lawsuits or things like that.
John Gibler, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you back.
Thank you very much, Sasha. I really appreciate it.
John Gibler is the author of a number of books, including Mexico Unconquered and To Die in Mexico. His latest book is I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us, an oral history of the attacks against the students of Ayotzinapa. That's published by City Lights Books. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.